Okay, welcome to the Stage Chef podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. This podcast exists to provide free educational content for young musicians entering an increasingly complex industry by telling the stories of some of the unsung heroes behind the success. So go to thestagechefpodcast.com for all episodes featuring musicians who discuss in detail the recording, writing and performing processes with the likes of Elvis Presley, David Bowie, Michael Jackson, The Beatles, Fleetwood Mac, Nick Cave, Oasis, Morrissey, Alanis Morissette, The Damned, The 1975, Bob Dylan, The Stone Roses, Jeff Lynne and Kraftwerk. Today we've been joined by John Bleese, a drummer with Robert Plant of Led Zeppelin and Paolo Nutini, Seal, and who 48 hours ago walked off stage from playing with Florence and the Machine at the Royal Albert Hall. Today we'll be discussing what on-stage communication looks like with Robert Plant, how feedback differs from the greats, and touring life with musicians who are your spouse, and also why play the drums with chopsticks? Because we've seen that happen in the past as well. So it's a pleasure to say that our guest today on the Stage Chef podcast is none other than John Bleese. Thanks for joining us today, John. How's it going?
It's a pleasure to be here, Chris. And yeah, it's going great. Thanks for having me.
Absolute pleasure. Now, on Wednesday, I sent you a WhatsApp and I said to you, all good Friday, few logistics. And you said, I'll reply to you in a bit. I'm just here at the moment. And you sent me a picture of your drum kit at the Royal Albert Hall, which I actually didn't know you were playing because I hadn't started actually looking into that until yesterday. And I deliberately didn't ask you how it was other than hearing from you that it was magical. Talk us through that event, the process beforehand as well, how it went and what made it magical.
Well, where to start? So the reason I sent you a picture was because I was balls deep at that point and there was no chance of getting a reply because the percussion, the amount of drums and percussion in that gig was quite colossal. I just had to deal with my kit, which was quite big as well. But, you know, I dealt with it myself so that I got a little bit more money.
Nice.
But that's by Dubai. But, that gig on Wednesday there was at the Albert Hall and it was playing Florence and the Machine's first album in its entirety, because it's 15 years old, with a full orchestra, choir. You asked how that kind of came about.
So how did it come about and what was the process, like rehearsals, that type of thing? Because there's a lot, you know, I saw a picture. It looked like there was like 80 people on stage. That might be exaggeration, but it did seem about as many as those.
No, I don't know how many people, but I think you're probably about right. You know, it was a big old do that. And
how is something like that pieced together, given that you're starting, I'd imagine, from a recording that happened 15 years ago, which is a very iconic album, I think. And, you know, there's a lot of memorable songs on there. At what point were you brought in and at what point were the choir brought in and how is that pieced together and who orchestrates that?
Well, the reason I get asked to do things like that is because it's through my friend Jules Buckley, who I've known for 20 years. And his career's kind of just gone wham like that. And it's getting to the point now where there's kind of no one that he's not worked with, you know. And he is the front man of these orchestras. And this one the other night was his own one. So he kind of handpicks the players for that. So he gave me a call probably about 3-4 months ago, so quite a long time ago, and said, are you around at this time? And I said, yes, I am. And I was, and he said, so this is the deal. And so when he has a gig like that, he comes up with a kind of idea. So it's the Florence and the Machine one. So he then pitched it to her. Okay, this is the funny thing about this gig was that the drummer, there was three kind of core drummers. Well, me on the main drum kit, two other guys playing like rhythm percussion. And then there was two orchestral percussionists as well. So he was pitching it that the three kind of bandy guys would all be standing. So I then started thinking about that and I had to listen to the music and I was like, because obviously playing the drums standing up, drum kit standing up is a bit of a no-go really. But her music, I listened to it. It didn't have much hi-hat going on. So I thought, do you want to know what? I could do this, Jules, you know, let's go for it. And then I started thinking about it over a couple of months. But to be honest, I was on tour with someone else all of June and July, August. But I was listening to the tracks, getting my head into it when I was out running or something. and thinking about sounds and stuff. And then it starts to get a bit more specific as you get closer to the time. But Jules works right up to the wire, like literally right up till 8 p.m. on Wednesday. There was some things that as a 80-piece band, you don't really know what, you know, for example, is it 3-4 or is it 1-2-3-4 or is it 1-2-1-2-3 back and in. And so you just have to really, and how that stuff comes about, he has a big team now, Jules, that do all the orchestrating. So he'll farm out some tracks for orchestrating. And then as a musician, you've got to be able to read. You know, it's you'd be nowhere on that if you're not reading.
So that's what I was going to ask you, is if there's three kind of percussionists from the band, drummers, and then there's also from the orchestra, I think you said a couple, are those parts written individually by Jules?
Yeah, and his team.
And his team, right.
Different orchestrators and arrangers,
yeah,
some of whom I know now. So you get a relationship with them. They might give you a phone call and say, look, is this playable? What kind of sound would you recommend for this? You know, how would you achieve that sound? And you can help with that. But most of the time they know what you're doing and you just turn up and read the parts. So it's that kind of thing.
And did you play standing up?
So I did. I in my studio here the week before the gig, you know, I was at home and I organized my drum kit and I thought, right, these sounds are going to work well. And then I started playing standing up and I realized quite quickly that it might cause some tension in areas that you're not normally getting tension because it's standing. So I started to research double pedals. I borrowed a double kick pedal off a friend because then you could have the pedal off to the side and your right foot would. And then I realized, no, I need a left-footed double pedal, of which that's pretty niche. And then I just decided to do it standing up. And then we did the first day rehearsal on Sunday with just the band. So that's, you asked about rehearsals. For this gig, how it was Sunday rehearsal, just the band. So that was me on drums, two percussionists playing rhythm stuff, guitarist, bass player, piano player, all of them covering, like, the guitarist had like five different instruments. Bass is like Moog bass, upright bass, electric bass. Piano player was playing upright piano, harpsichord, harmonium. And so we're all having to be covering a lot of ground. And then on the Monday, we did a rehearsal with the choir. Florence came in the afternoon then. Tuesday, full BIFTA, orchestra, choir, brass, the works. Wednesday, into the hall, sound check, afternoon rehearsal, evening gig. And so not much time. I mean, I play in a lot of bands and stuff as well. And sometimes in bands, you rehearse for weeks. But I'm coming from a background that's, turn up and read it and nail it. So, like, those orchestra guys that I've been playing with this week are, like, top call A-list kind of players, you know. There's no messing about, you know.
Did anything go wrong?
No, not on the gig.
Wow.
No, nothing went wrong.
That's a try.
You know, a few things. I felt a couple of songs we played it better in the sound check. And I did one of those orchestra things with Jules with a guy called Father John Misty last year.
Did you?
Yeah.
Love FJM.
Yeah. So we did a gig of the music of Scott Walker with him being Scott Walker. What's up?
Right. Okay. So straight in my notes, FJM got asked about that because I've travelled the country to see that guy play. So that's
seriously?
Big fan.
Well, he's I love Fleet Foxes. And he's obviously a drummer. So, and I've seen his band play at festivals. What a band. Great band. And I was playing with Paolo in Mexico and they were on same time. We were at the same backstage bit and I got chatting to his drummer. Now, I can't remember if his name's Richard or Dan because on Instagram he's called Dan Bailey or D. Richard. So I can't remember. I got his name wrong. He was like, actually, my name's... I was like, but on Instagram it's Richard. And he was like, no, but I'm actually Dan.
Oh, there we go.
But anyway, he's a bloody lovely guy and a great drummer. And then the similar thing happens, you know, last year. I think it was last year, this gig. Jules was like, hey, are you around on these dates? And I said, yes, I am. Okay, it's Father John Misty at the Barbican doing the Scott Walker thing. And I'd done the Scott Walker thing with him at the proms 4 years ago, something like that, maybe more. That was with Jarvis Cocker, the guy for Elbow, Guy Garvey.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
so it's all these. It was good, but to be honest, Father John Misty, forgotten his real name, but he did a great job. He killed that. He'd been learning it all, and the drummer Dan had told me, yeah, he's on tour and he's just practicing Scott Walker stuff. And he turned up and he knew it instantly. And when he came into rehearsal, and on that one, you got to play real quiet. You generally need to bring it back with the orchestras anyway. And I was surprised I didn't get told off on the Florence one because it's all big drums, you know. But it seemed to work out all right. And I guess done enough of those kind of things now to know where I can sit, where I can like push, you know. Because he's a drummer, I was thinking, wow, you know, and the sound on those Scott Walker records is so great, you know, that I love those albums. And my art teacher at school loved them, Miss Summers, if you're listening. And yeah, she wrote to me after that. So I saw you playing with Scott Walker, you know, the thing on the proms. And, but anyway, we got chatting drums, you know, on the first break when he was in with the orchestra. And he came up, he was like, oh, your drums sound really good, you know. And I was really happy about that because it was just a hire kit. I decided to do that gig just with a hire kit and just tune it well. And he was loving it. And then he had a little go, and then we just chatted about drummers and stuff that we liked. And I said, oh, man, you're great with Fleet Foxes and everything. And, but he was a fantastic front man and a lovely guy to spend a few days with.
Yeah, brilliant, brilliant artist. I'd recommend listeners to check his stuff out. You talked about one teacher there. Tell us about Colin Wilson, Mr. Wilson.
Oh, right.
I believe, so you grew up in Prestwick in Ayrshire. And
yeah, you've done your research.
Yeah, man. That's what we do here. And yes. Mr. Colin Wilson, tell us about Colin Wilson in regards to what did you learn from him?
Well,
that you still put in your practice today, and what job would you be doing, do you think, today if he hadn't come along in your life? Would it be the same? It might be the same, might be different.
Well, I don't know. Sometimes I think about that. I don't know if I would still be a musician if I didn't have was fortunate to have this school. I mean, the school I went to is just a bog standard, secondary school in Scotland, in Prestwick. Not fancy, nothing. But Colin Wilson was the head of the music department and he was right into music. And so was Mr. Malpass, who was the brass instructor. So for this little school, we had a big band, brass band, string orchestra. There was just so much music going on and so much opportunity for young musicians. And there was little bands getting formed as well. I spent all my lunch breaks and intervals in the music department hanging out just because it's where I felt at home. From the minute I got into it, I just was like, I love this. Whether that would have happened without this school, this environment, I don't know. But all I know is that I'm incredibly grateful for it because it doesn't exist anymore, I don't think. It was just a very special time. And I was very lucky to be there at that time. You know, it was great. We did loads of gigs around, even like, you know, nursing homes, little village fets, whatever. But we'd take all the kit and set it all up. And that school band, the big band, weirdly, we didn't have a rhythm section. It was all on backing track. He had a synthesizer that played it all. And the drummer, you got a click. So you asked what skills I still use. All of it. It's the same thing as what I'm doing now. It's just I was doing it then in school band. And not because it's click or anything. It's following a conductor. It's reading music. It's getting on with people. It's all the skills that you need as a musician was happening for me then because of Mr. Wilson, Mr. Malpass, and the environment they created. And it was totally cool. It was such a laugh, you know. We went on tour. We went to Dublin, you know. And he kind of treated us like pro musicians, you know.
Nice.
And you know, he made us, you know, get our standard up, and you know, and we did gigs in the local theatre, the Gaiety Theatre, and it was a big deal.
So when you were that age and you're thinking about going into the music industry, your environment, did you feel that you were being encouraged to go into the music industry, or was there anyone who was like, John, come on, music industry? Because we have a lot of listeners right now who will be in exactly your shoes then,
right,
if that is the case. So what would you advise around that?
Well, I'd say to them as well, if anyone, any of your young listeners wanted to reach out to me, they're more than welcome. I'm totally happy to help anybody and pass on anything I know. I'm into that. Mm. I was lucky in that I had the most supportive, encouraging mum and dad I could have ever wanted. And they, you know, I said, I want to be a drummer, you know, and they went, they were both school teachers, and they said, all right then. And then I got into, they bought me a cheap kit to start to see if it's kind of going to stick, you know, there's no point getting it in for. And then I was over the moon. And then a couple of years after that, when I was batshit about it, they got me a better kit, a Yamaha kit. And that lasted me for years. And they encouraged me all the time. And then when I started to play in band, like when I was about 15, 16, I started to get asked to do like pub gigs with older people, you know, playing in pubs, playing jazz, covers, you know, rock and roll, whatever. And my dad would take me and we'd humph the drums into the venue and we had a carpet. I've still got it now. I said, Dad, drums go on carpets so they don't slide around. I need to get a carpet because I'm doing these gigs and like the bass drum's over by the, you know, and my dad, we went to the local carpet place and just said, have you got any offcuts? Like my son needs one for the under his drums. And they're like, aye, sure, pal, aye, you can take some of that. And, you know, so I was so fortunate. And even where my mum, and where I grew up and where my mum lives now, there's, at the time when I was a teenager, playing literally to get home from school and then play along to as much Bon Jovi as I could. It must have pissed the neighbours off, something rotten. And there was a local councillor behind us, and he came round and complained to my mum, and my mum just told him what for. She was like, she was like, my son needs to practice the drums because he's going to be a drummer, and he left us alone. And anyway, and now I am a drummer. I mean, it all worked out kind of for me that what I wanted to do, I've been doing it. But if you don't have that situation where you've got support around you, it can be hard to remain motivated, I guess. But if you feel it in your gut and that is what your passion is, don't let anything stop you. That's what I'd say, is just, you know, just keep on your path, whatever it is that you're doing.
And when you were in those emerging years before kind of getting the really kind of big gigs, how did your perception of the music industry and what it would be differ to what it is, given now you've played such huge, you know, high profile shows?
I don't know if I thought about it too much when I was younger. I just kind of went along with the flow and tried to just, right, what am I doing today? Right, playing a wedding gig in a marquee or a barn or playing, when I was young, playing Kayleys all over the shop. And, I guess maybe I did think, wow, I wonder what it would be like to play with, you know, some famous person, like see someone famous on the television. You know, when I'm young, I'm trying to put myself back into, you know, I'm watching Jules Holland and I'm like, you know, actually, I remember, because when you asked me to do this, you said, oh, you know, Clive Deamer. And I said, yeah, I'm mates with Clive, you know, who has, for listeners who aren't aware of Clive, he's an amazing drummer who's played with Radiohead, Portishead, Robert Plant, all kinds of people. And I remember seeing him on Jules Holland when I was young. and seeing him play with Robert Plant, and thinking, wow, I really loved the band, you know. And I maybe thought, well, wonder what that's like. And then fast forward, you know.
We're at his wedding.
20 years, yeah. And I'm at Clive's wedding.
Yeah.
And then I played with Robert Plant for like 3-4 years with some of the people that were in that band with Clive.
And, that's mad.
And then you're kind of, and so I kind of know what it's like now. But yeah, I guess when you're young, you've got all these thoughts going around in your head, like, what's that like? What's, you know, wonder what it's like. Wonder what the backstage is like. Yeah, I remember getting brought up on stage at the Singing Kettle, just randomly, like, not to play or anything, to play music. And we went backstage, and I saw backstage, and they had some Game Boys to keep the kids entertained. I thought it was amazing. Now, nice. Now a backstage is pretty boring.
Depends whose it is. What do you find most challenging about touring, if anything?
For me, it's the boredom can a little bit. It can get, not boredom, that's maybe the wrong word, but I like it for the routine, because I like routine, and often in the music business, there's not any routine. So when you go on tour, it's an opportunity to have a routine. And I love that. You know, it's like, okay, for me, it would look like something like bus arrives at venue, go for a run, come back, have shower, do a bit of practice, have lunch, call some people. I find that's really important if you're on tour, to try and stay connected. I'm not very good at that. I end up being in my own little world, and I forget to keep in touch with people. So that's something I'm working on now. But then that kind of routine can get a little bit boring, because I'm also, I like things to be changing all the time. Fortunately, the artists I tend to go on tour with are always changing a song, a set, an arrangement, a section of a song, a feel of a song, a key of a song, whatever. It's never dull.
And that's a really interesting area, because we've had this as a topic in recent episodes as well, actually. How do you best deal with that? So if you're in a sound check in the afternoon and an artist says to you, okay, we're going to change things up for tonight, what are you doing in that moment when they're maybe working through it or explaining what they want you to do? Are you writing down notes? Are you making mental, you know, are you memorizing it? Are you visualizing it? How best, if there's a drummer who's in your shoes, who's been said, right, okay, tonight we're changing things up, what advice would you give them in that exact moment to thrive later on in the evening?
Well, I used to write everything down. So that would help me to remember things. And I would get, like, say something was going to be different within a set. If that different thing, I would have a note about it, because I know if I had that, I've got like a safety. Whereas now, I've done that. I did that for so long. So now I like to challenge myself to do it without it.
Wow.
Depending how hard it is. Do you know what I mean? Like, because I found it really, if you're reading your notes, you're maybe not present within the moment. And I'm really trying to be present in that moment. So when people are changing things and everything, my role is to support that as best I can, and sometimes I'm not great at that, depending on what's happening that day. You know, I put my hands up, I can be not in the mood for it, maybe, you know, oh god, here we go, another change, whatever. But in reality what I'm trying to do is what the person, artist or MD or whoever it is trying to achieve, my job's to try and help that go along as smoothly as possible and as well as it can, you know. And so I try and just keep it on my head. When it gets to that moment, know it's coming, relax, don't stress about it, and then just let it happen, let it come through you.
That's really interesting, because I know that when you worked for Robert Plant, I think you once said that sometimes the songs could change every day or overnight or through a conversation at breakfast. And it's so good that you can feel so kind of relaxed around that. And I wonder if that's...
I think doing that gig has made me come out the end of it like what I just kind of tried to explain. Because, you know, on the van and the way there, maybe not even, maybe to a sound check, definitely to a sound check on the van on the way there. That was often discussion time about new song, changing a song. And it would be like, you know, you'd be like, what, we're going to do that now? Like, okay, headphones in the van. And then you get there, it's like 4 o'clock. And then it's like, you have a little, like, couple of minutes on the drums or whatever you need to do to prepare. And then he comes out and you're doing it. And if it doesn't sound great, it's binned. And, you know, that's okay. A few things got binned. They didn't work. And that's okay. But you are trying to get it great, you know, to give it a good go. So, yeah, you just, I think having that experience with him has kind of, it's given me a lot of, not in an egotistical way, but it's given me some confidence to just know that, yeah, I can do this. Do you know what I mean?
Which is an interesting journey, because there's a very fascinating story around this, which I believe is that you actually put forward yourself to work with Robert Plant, and initially he rejected your first audition tape, which I think was doing stuff with different musicians, and then you went back again with a different tape doing much more kind of obscure type of music and less kind of mainstream or well known and working with high profile people. And he was like, yeah, I like that guy, I want to work with that guy. So yeah, how did you feel initially, like, with someone of his profile saying no, not for me? That must have, like, that must have been difficult to hear.
Yeah, because, I mean, yeah, that very initial moment was, hey, can you prepare a little, like a show reel, I don't know what you want to call it, a little selection of things that you've done so that Robert can see you play, you know. And so I put together some stuff of me playing with high-profile artists, because normally that's the kind of thing that impresses a manager or something like that, you know. Now, in my head, anyway, you know, they want to say, oh, you've played with X, Y, and Z. Oh, that's great. You know, you, and also if you're up for a gig like that, you do need to have had some experience of playing large rooms. I think that's fair enough to say, because if you've just been, you know, it's just all the stuff that comes with it. You need to be able to have the ability to deal with these changes quick, like what we're saying, and just everything else that comes along with a gig like that. So I put together a reel like that, and then I got the word back, yeah, Robert's not really feeling this, because obviously he doesn't need to, you know that he's worked with everyone in the world, you know. And, you know, it's Robert Plant. He was in Led Zeppelin. So, you know, you don't need to impress him with playing with whoever. So, you know, my friends in the band said, put together another one of all the more obscure, improvised, niche kind of releases and things that you've done over the years. And so I did. And he loved it. So, well, I don't know if he definitely liked it, you know.
Well, he hired you.
And then he invited me to the Albert Hall. And when I was there 2 days ago, I saw the bar where I met him for the first time. It's kind of like, you know, like the after show bar type thing. Our dressing room was right next to it. So I saw that, and it brought back that memory, you know, of when I met him in person for the first time. And it's not always about the kind of high profile stuff, is it, you know?
No, that's super interesting. And that kind of reflects a lot of the music he does now. I can imagine he'd be more interested in the kind of jazz or the more kind of, less mainstream stuff in how he's producing music today. How did he give you feedback? And how did his feedback compare to other people? So if he was happy or if he wasn't happy, like what was his process to do that, so you knew how to improve?
Well, you could tell a lot from how he was on stage, which a lot of the time, I mean, that is his happy place, if you want to call it that. He's still traveling the world doing gigs, you know. That's quite incredible. And so you could tell a lot from him just turning around, looking at you in the band, if he's enjoying it. There was a lot of direction from hands and eyes, you know, and body movements. And then afterwards, there'd always be a little discussion, maybe. Not always, but I mean, I do remember I always got a little drum solo in that. And yeah, well, towards the end of the thing. And so it was just totally free form. I could do whatever I wanted, which I found very intimidating at the time, because you're playing to, like, maybe, I don't know, 15, 20,000 people. And John Bonham did the best drum solos ever. And Planty was a part of that, obviously. So I did find it pretty intimidating, but he was so encouraging. And always, I do remember actually that always, when that came into the set, he loved it because it's improvised. And anything can happen. And I pushed it. You know, I would do things about pushing the tempo and then slowing down. And when that came out one night and I got that just happened, and I was like, oh, I'm going to go with it, and started doing like polyrhythms, you know, that would give the impression of speeding up and then slowing down. He was right into that. And then afterwards, he would always comment on the drum solo to me as we were walking off. He'd say, you know that bit that you did? Oh, that was great. Or why didn't you develop that longer? You know, and the bits that he would always pull me up, or not pull me up, but mention and say, why didn't you, that was great, that bit. Why didn't you stay on that for a little while? They were always in my head when I was playing it, the moments where I thought, oh man, I'm away doing something, I should have stayed there, you know? And I loved that. I mean, that's just such a good memory for me, that little moment walking off some massive gig and him saying to me, talking to me about my improvised drum solo.
And you once said that it felt like being in a band with him, which is really nice, because often that type of gig...
How did that happen?
How did he cultivate that so it didn't feel like you're kind of a backing band for a front person?
Because there's no... Musically, there was no real hierarchy. You know, he's the name that sells loads of tickets. But it happened because he's open. He's experienced enough and humble enough to let the musicians that he's chose to play with bring their thing and collectively create something. And sure, he would have the overall kind of say, but really it's very open like that. And that's what it's like with Paolo as well. I've played with people where it's, you know, like the Florence thing, it's like you turn up, you do the gig. The Seal, when I play with Seal, it's very much like that. It's like, it doesn't feel as much of a band. I feel like I'm like hired to
provide a service,
to nail those drums. Yeah. And I'll do that because I like it, and they're treating me well, and it's I'm happy to be there. But with Robert's band and Paolo's band, it feels like a band, even though it is technically a session band on paper, you know how it works musically and everything. You've got all the input, you know, so it's great.
But from a democratic point of view, in regards to being in a band, that probably doesn't, you know, can you say to Paolo, you know, actually, I think we should do it this way? Or is that kind of his vision and you just enable that to happen?
No, we could say that. Easy.
Nice.
And with Robert. Nice. I mean, it's not like a band as in some of the people that you've had on the show who are in a band.
Mm.
You know, when you're in a band, everything's split certain ways, royalties, etc. You know, it all gets, when that kind of stuff comes in, it's just a little bit different, but the feel of it is not a session band, and I hope it comes across like that.
Yeah, I think it definitely does, certainly from some of the coverage that I've seen. One thing that you touched upon there, which I think is really interesting, is if you're an emerging artist now and you get lucky enough that someone says, oh, this person's a really great drummer, bass player, get them involved. How would you advise them, if they weren't experienced, to navigate those first conversations about what the pay would be? Like, what should the process be, and what is it in reality? Because it's such a delicate conversation, I know, but there's a lot of people who get exploited in that situation, or not ask and then don't get paid. You know, how best to go about that so it isn't awkward?
Well, it's a very, the music business is the Wild West, isn't it?
Really? It is, yeah.
And there's no real kind of structure to it. When there is structure, I like it. Like, see, the orchestral stuff, like, there's structure to that.
Mm.
You know, there's rates and there's, you know. But even for that, like, for the Florence thing this week, we got offered an amount of money, the band players. Maybe I shouldn't be talking about this, I don't know. But and it was good, but we felt that it should be more. And we collectively put a very nice email together and sent it off to the BBC, and we got more money.
Wow.
And my experience with this stuff, and it's only like when I was younger, I didn't want to do it. But honestly, no matter what level, I've found that if you ask, I've always got it. And so I would say to people, it's how you ask, though, you know. Can't just be like, I'm not doing it for that. Give me more money. You know, it doesn't work like that. You got to think about empathetic, clever, you know, you got to be smart about it. But in my experience, even when it was like doing gigs for 50 quid and being like, well, you know, that's for the amount that's involved in this, it should be whatever. Oh God, sorry. You know, yeah, okay. And I sometimes a lot of drummers, or not a lot, but I can think of a couple of people called up and said, "Hey man, I'm having trouble with this. I think that the fee should be more and everything." And I've just encouraged them. I said, "Look, just explain to the artist or the manager, whoever it is, what you need to do to make this gig happen, the amount of hours involved, and where you're at in your skill set." And genuinely, I would hope that people would listen to that, you know. But there's maybe times where someone will say, well, we'll just get someone else then. And you have to be, when you do that, you have to be prepared that they might just get someone else. But in my experience, and I don't know why, it's always kind of worked out.
Is there anything else you'd say about how people can avoid being ripped off in any way in the music industry? You know, you said the Wild West. We had Kate Nash on last year, and we basically came to the conclusion that the music industry just needs a massive fuck off HR department, basically, to regulate things. So, like, people that just aren't being ripped off. So, do you think there's anything else you know, emerging artists, so they don't get kind of ripped off in some way?
I need to think about it a bit more, but the first thing that comes to my head is maybe just communicate with a lot of people, as many people as you can, and ask, you know, try to get a ballpark figure about, because there's levels, you know, that's the thing. There are levels to these things. You can't get the same money, you know, when you're playing with Robert Plant, when you're playing a 50, you know, when you're playing a nifty 50 jazz gig at the Dog and Duck. You know, and you have to be okay with that, because you have to mentally understand that, you have to understand that your worth isn't money. It's what do you want to be there? You know, what you might be getting more out of different things, out of different situations. It's not always financial, but I know that you're asking me specifically about how to not get ripped off. And so having an idea about where the gig that you're doing should be priced, I think maybe people might not know that. And also I would encourage younger people to not accept low fees, because it shafts everyone.
Yeah.
So I would encourage people, I don't know enough about this, but I think there's a lot of young people doing gigs for not much money, and I've heard on gigs that should be paying the money. And that shafts it for everybody.
So, that's great advice.
So I would really encourage people to, because as musicians, as a community, We want things to get better. And if people are doing gigs for low rates, it shafts everyone.
Chopsticks.
Well,
how did that come about?
There's a great jump. There's some great drummers that play with chopsticks occasionally. There's a guy called Thomas Stronan and a guy called Joey Barron, and it's just a different sound, and it really gets you out of a pickle sometimes. And I mean, you know, not in some gigs, you know, when you're playing loud, but like when if people need quiet textural things, you need to have options. And drums with chopsticks sound absolutely amazing. It sounds like programmed, toppy, you know, kind of drum. And you can also play real intricate stuff and get that sound. If you're playing thin, like Square Pusher Aphex 20 type thing, you can get a real... It's just a different sound.
Nice. Yeah, there's some nice videos that we've seen of you playing them, and it looks great. It's just very, very unique. If you could relive a gig that you've played, but from the audience perspective, which one would you pick?
I've heard you ask that question to a couple other people, and I honestly don't know. I mean, I would go back and watch any of the gigs I did with Robert. I think there's not one specific one, but did you ask if to watch myself play?
Yeah. So if you could like somehow just go watch from the back of the room.
Yeah, definitely be a gig with Robert, because I'd be, you know, if there was two of me, one in the drums and one in the audience, I would love to see myself playing with him, you know.
Nice. So let's talk Paolo.
Right.
What makes him a unique person to work with on a daily basis when you're on tour?
Where do I start? he's a unique character, you know. All these people, everyone's unique in their own way, aren't they? But I guess I don't really know, because I've known Paolo since 2015, and we're both Scottish. So we have that kind of bond, really. And do our stuff together, you know, like whatever it is, recording, touring, gigging. And I don't think too much about it, but it's my wife that says, God, that's quite unique what you're up to there. And I'm like, is it? I don't know. But he's got an incredible voice.
Mm.
And I love playing drums behind it, you know, behind them. And it's great. It's cool where we're at now. Like, he had a big break for a while. And then I was a big part of the latest album. And it did pretty well, you know. And again, I don't really know, but it did go to number one. So I kind of see that as... And people seem to enjoy it. We've just done like 2.5 years worth of gigs, and I don't think there was one that wasn't sold out. And
didn't you do it like a gig in a really small venue that used to be somewhere he grew up?
We finished the tour there in Paisley, which is his hometown.
Yeah.
And we raised 300 grand. I mean, we, Paolo, really. But we all did the gig for free. So did everybody involved, from the trucks to the buses to the PA lights. And so we all chipped in that way. But Paolo managed to raise 300 grand on this gig because he put... It's only 1,000 capacity.
Mm.
So the theory was a text ballot. You could enter four times for a pair of tickets. Now, enough people entered to raise, and it was £3 a text, I think.
Mm.
We raised 300 grand, and that's gone to one bigger charity and one local charity in Paisley, where that kind of money, 150 grand, is going to change lives. And that's awesome. And so Paulo's good like that. You know, he does a lot of wee things that, I mean, people know about that, you know, but he does a lot of nice things for organisations, and, you know, he's good like that.
Did you support Liam at Nebworth? Because he was... Mm-hmm. I was there. Oh, that's interesting.
You're a big Oasis fan.
Well, might be a bit of a giveaway, but yeah. So, and Paolo, yes. It was to my... I remember being stood at the bar, queuing up for these beers, and there was a collective gasp that he had the gall to do Half the World Away, a Noel song at Nebworth. That was incredible. And actually, people started singing along. I was like, wow, this guy's actually going to go there. And actually, and he actually kind of nailed it. Like, can you remember rehearsing that?
Well, he just did it himself. And Gav, who plays guitar, Gav plays pretty much everything. He played trumpet.
Nice.
And they didn't rehearse it at all. Paulo said, as we were walking up, I think I'm going to do that. Do you want to play some trumpet on it? And Gav was like, That's how it works. And it did go down really well. I've got a video of that from the side of the stage. I'll send you it.
Yeah, I do. That's amazing.
But Liam is a massive Paulo fan.
Wow.
Which totally baffles me, but Liam loves Paulo's song New Shoes.
Really?
Yeah. It's bizarre.
Maybe that's why I asked him to do the gig. You know, it was a big show. Yeah,
Liam really likes Paulo, apparently. You know, so... And, yeah, just from what Paulo's told me, he's like, yeah, Liam loves New Shoes.
So that day, remind us, talk us of that day, because... You know, you obviously play a lot of big gigs, but there was a lot of people there. That was a big old field.
That was a big gig.
That was a big event. That really was.
It was a great atmosphere.
Yeah. What are your memories of it?
Just that it was a cracking atmosphere. I remember thinking it wouldn't be. I thought there'd be, I mean, how big was that? 80, 90,000, something like that. I thought it'd be a bit leery and not very... The crowd wouldn't be so responsive for us, or even if there was a crowd... But I remember coming out, and I'd say it was like 70 or 80,000 there. Like, it was pretty much capacity, so we got told. And that, I thought it was, and just the atmosphere was great. And when Paulo did that Noel song, it did go down well. People went bonkers for it, and then it meant that, you know, I don't know. Our set seemed to go down well, but at that point, as I say, Paulo had a big break for about 8 years. Yeah. And we'd just come back, you know, to playing. So we'd played like 5 nights at the 100 Club in London. We were doing a bunch of small shows to kind of get us back into playing. And then there was the Nebworth and headlining this festival in Glasgow called Transmit, which is like 50-odd thousand. And those were like, if we were to go and do one of those big gigs now, it's much more comfortable. Because we've done loads of we've done our share of big gigs now. But at that point, it was like Nebworth was huge, you know. And
What would a young writer learn observing Paulo compose and write music that they might not learn from anyone else?
Well, he is quite unique in that regard. He doesn't do what a lot of people do, like make a polished demo, or he does sometimes have ideas on what guitar parts, drum parts, keyboard parts might be, so sometimes he does have an idea and he says, this is what I'd like this to, the zone it should be in. But a lot of the time, he's, even if he does have the idea in his head, he comes to the studio open to listening to what could happen. So I think that's quite a good thing, because a lot of writers or people, even when I'm doing drum sessions and stuff for people, they really want the drums to be like this and they're very attached to it. I think there's a lot to be said to just letting things breathe a little, you know? So he definitely does that. He lets things mature over a very long time. And I think you get better results. I think you get more like, rather than just like, right, demo all up, right, let's book a drummer, let's book, you know. And I get it. That's the cheaper way to do it. But I've been in studios with him where there's like 2 days where we do nothing. We just hang out. And not everyone can do that because, you know, it's like we're all getting paid, the studio's getting paid, and Paolo's just like, yeah, not feeling it.
Wow.
So it took me a long time to get used to that because I'm coming from a place where it's like, fucking hell, this studio's costing this much money and we want to get this recording done. But with him, it's like, it's just got to be all about the mood and the feel. And when he gets that and we're in that, bam, go.
Is there any piece of like music memorabilia that you have or something that you've kept that's like super important to you that reminds you of a certain tour that you went on or anything that's, you know, if the house was burning down and the family was safe and you'd want to grab?
Well, I've got a lot of gig posters from all the tours I've done. Paolo makes great posters and Robert as well. And I've got some really nice signed things from Robert. You know, so they mean a bit from my music life. I don't know. If the house was burning down, I wouldn't be too bothered. But, you know, I've got all my laminates and stuff. And Terry at Rockfield made me this. This is quite cool.
Oh, nice.
I don't know. But Rockfield Studios in Wales.
It's like a clock, right?
Yeah, but it's made out of one of the old tapes.
Oh, yeah, of course, right.
And I don't know what was this reel, but he made 30 of them and he gave one to me.
Oh,
and
they're beautiful.
Terry's the handyman at Rockfield who built the amazing plate and echo rooms there, and he's just become a good friend. He's awesome. He actually used to do Robert Plant's garden for a bit. So there's many connections with Terry. Love Terry. Love him.
And what's coming up for you next?
Well, going to be recording with Paolo. That's happening pretty soon. I do this Pete Tong Orchestra.
Yeah.
Playing dance music in arenas with an orchestra. This is the 10th year of it. And so that's got a tour in December. And October and November, I'm going to be doing a lot of DIY in the house. We're doing up a house, and but I've got this studio now, which is amazing, and I do a lot of recording for film and TV from here. So my plan is hopefully to punt that a bit, and I am working on a couple of shows. I did this show called Terminal List on Amazon, and it was the most watched thing on Amazon, apparently. So there's a sequel and a prequel for that coming out. Was with Chris Pratt, but I think someone else is doing it now. And then I've started working on a Sherlock Holmes, which is coming out in 2025.
Wow.
So, yeah, that's not me composing the music, but I do the drums and percussion. And there's always little sessions come up. So I love doing that from here.
You're living the dream. You're literally playing the instrument you love and you get paid for it, doing it in lots of different fields. I mean, that's where everyone gets.
I feel incredibly grateful. And I know it's not come without hard work, you know.
Yeah.
All of this stuff, hard work. But touch wood, I can keep doing what I've been doing because I like where I'm at. And I'm just excited about what's happening in the future. I don't know that's the thing about being a musician as well, for all your younger listeners. You don't know what's coming next, really. And then you can get busy with something for a long time and then it ends and then you tumbleweed. And you just, you know, it gets a bit easier, but not really. But I feel incredibly grateful to have had the opportunities I've had, and I've, you know, I wish it for everybody, you know. The music, being a musician is fantastic.
And what's one last bit of advice that you'd give to a musician that's most going to help them in the music industry? that you haven't said already? Because there's plenty of it out there. What would you say?
Yeah. I would say some people disagree with this, but I think say yes to everything. You know, that might not work for some people, but you never know what will come of an opportunity. So if you get an opportunity, and no matter what it is, you know, like, it might, 9 times out of 10, it might lead to something else, because you'll meet someone, you know, you just never know, like, you know, the barman or something might have a band and they need a drummer or a, whatever it is that you do. And so I do subscribe to that philosophy of say yes to everything, because you just never know, and it'll just snowball into different things. Because if you're just sat at home twiddling your thumbs, then nothing will happen. But I do understand that that's maybe the right process for some people, that if they're an artist and they're working on their craft, you know, that's the thing. But for me, as an active kind of gigging musician, it's all about getting out there and playing with people, really. So I would say, get out and play.
Amazing. Yeah. Listen, thank you for your wisdom, your advice, your honesty. There's so much that I've taken from the last kind of hour or so.
Bless you.
Good luck with the house rebuild, and good luck with the shows with Pete Tong later in the year, and the recording with Paolo as well. Thanks for everything that you've done in the last hour or so. It's been fantastic. And as always, thanks for being a great guest on the Stage Show podcast.
Thank you, Chris, for asking me. A real honour. Thank you so much.